Need to speak to the victim, Sandoval said. I wasn't Spaceboy or Henry Denton. I was the victim. Coach Raskin's office was cramped, and I had to gulp for breath to get enough air into my lungs. Sandoval must have read my mind because she said, Alone. Everyone cleared out, but Principal DeShields hovered outside the doorway, probably mentally strategizing damage control. Officer Sandoval produced a reporter's notepad and pen from her pocket and turned the full weight of her somber gaze upon me. It was the kind of look I knew could extract the truth, the way a dentist tears free a rotten molar. Only Sandoval wouldn't use Novocaine. Walk me through what happened. I recounted the attack, sticking to the facts and avoiding conjecture. Even though I was sure I knew the identities of the three aliens who attacked me, I couldn't prove it. Officer Sandoval listened closely but didn't write anything down. I didn't tell her about Jesse speaking to me. They were wearing masks?
Yeah.
Did you hear their voices? Could you identify them if you heard them again? Marcus McCoy had called me Spaceboy so many times that I knew by heart the way his faint southern accent stretched out the A and clipped the Y, but doubt lingered. Maybe I'd imagined it. His voice, the smell of summer. I didn't want to believe Marcus was capable of attacking me.
No, nothing.
Sandoval frowned and scribbled in her notebook. Do you know why anyone would have targeted you? I could have given her 100 reasons. I was Spaceboy. Marcus was still pissed I'd refused to hook up with him again. Adrian wanted revenge for our fight in the locker room. I was Spaceboy. I was weak. Fuck it. Fuck this place. Fuck them all. It's Halloween, I said, and I was an easy target. Officer Sandoval pursed her lips. She definitely wasn't buying that line of bullshit. However, I'd endured enough shame for one day. I was sure Principal DeShields, Coach Rankin, or anyone else she asked could tell her what she wanted to know. I was done talking. The sharp rattle of a slamming door outside the office caused Officer Sandoval to glance over her shoulder, but I knew who it was before the shouting began. My mom had come to take me home. The sluggers abducted me from the bath. I'd spent 2 hours under running water, scrubbing with washcloths and loofahs until my skin was red and raw. My mom kept trying to invade the bathroom under the guise of offering me different methods of removing the paint, the oddest of which was a stick of butter, and I had to lock the door to get any privacy. Diego sent me a handful of text messages, at first asking where I was, then begging me to let him know I was all right. I felt terrible about not returning his texts, but I couldn't bear any more pity, especially not from him. I also figured out what the one more thing was while Mom drove me home from school. A photo of me sprawled on the shower floor, bound in green, wearing only a gray alien mask, had spread virally through Snowflake, each new person who shared it heaping on derision. I tried to trace it back to the original poster, but eventually gave up. Spaceboy had become an international phenomenon. I was Raumjunge in Germany, Garçon Cosmique in France, Uchu Nushoen in Japan, Chico Cosmico in Spain, and Rumtiongen in the Netherlands. At least Marcus had blurred out my junk before exposing me to the world. "I'm not pressing the goddamn button," I shouted. My voice didn't echo in the exam room. The darkness devoured it in a way that reminded me of the auditorium where I'd watched Jesse rehearse the Snow Queen freshman year. He only had a small part, but he spoke his lines as if he were the lead. His strong tenor reached even the back row where Audrey and I sat, she doing her homework, and I unable to take my eyes off the boy flapping his wings, willing us to believe he was a crow. The rotating projection of the earth disappeared, but the button remained, as either a taunt or a promise. I didn't know which, and I didn't care. Fuck it.
Why me?
Though the sluggers had left me alone in the room, I knew they were watching. They were always watching.
If you can save Earth, then do it. Why do you need me?
Even if they had answered, I doubt I would have comprehended them any more than a rat would understand the reasons a scientist dropped him in a maze and forced him to navigate it for the cheese at the end. I was startled by a slugger who appeared from the darkness and approached me at a crawl. I'd never noticed before, but it had tiny legs that grew from it like a centipede's. They were absorbed back into its body when it halted.
What?
From my supine position on the metal slab, the sluggers had all looked the same, but this one was close enough that I could distinguish fractal patterns on its skin in a million shades of green and brown. The deeper I followed, the farther they led. And they weren't static, either. The intricate designs changed in subtle ways. I sat up, swung my legs around, and slid off the edge of the slab.
Is that how you communicate with one another?
I wondered aloud as I observed the body markings swirl and transform in an endless dance. They were beautiful. I shed my anger standing there, sloughed off the dead weight of it.
Do you want me to press the button?
The slugger didn't respond. It simply lingered, motionless except for the designs on its skin and its round eyes floating on their stalks.
If you want me to press it, I will, but you've got to promise never to send me back.
Without my anger to support me, I faltered. My legs trembled, and I collapsed to the floor. I searched for the horizon, but saw nothing. Without my anger, I was adrift and drowning. Marcus had attacked me, and Nana had Alzheimer's, and Jesse had killed himself, and Charlie was having a baby. I was helpless to stop any of it. I'd been robbed of hope as surely as Nana was being robbed of her memories. Please, don't send me back.
The alien turned and crawled toward the darkness. I thought it was abandoning me, but it stopped at the edge of the shadows and waited.
This behavior was new, and I watched it curiously. After a moment, a floppy appendage grew out of the upper half of its body and waggled in the air, almost like it was waving at me.
"Do you want me to follow you?"
My voice was thick with mucus, and I scrubbed away my tears with the back of my hand. The slugger waved until I stood up, and then its arm melted back into its body. The slugger led me into the shadows. I'd always imagined there were walls behind the dark, and I was surprised when there weren't. The shadows enveloped me, and I stopped and held my hand an inch in front of my face. It wasn't simply dark, it was the complete absence of light. My heart began to race, but I walked on. I was prepared to spend my life in a cage as the centerpiece of their intergalactic zoo if it meant never returning to Calypso. The farther I walked, the more confident I grew. I kept my hand extended in front of me to avoid stumbling into anything. I didn't even know if the slugger was still there. I just kept walking. I wondered how it could see without light, and it dawned on me that the darkness was probably natural to the aliens. The lights in the exam room were for my benefit. The possibilities were endless and exciting. Did their eyes perceive heat? Radiation? Maybe they could see my atoms, and I was merely bits of organic code for them to manipulate. The sluggers were so fundamentally different from humans that it was a wonder they understood me at all. How ugly we must look to them, spilling light into every dark corner to push back the shadows, blinding ourselves to the true beauty of emptiness. Thank God for nipples. My hands brushed against something smooth, and I halted. I searched for a door or handle, but found nothing.
What now?
As if to answer, a hole appeared in the wall, and a narrow beam of light struck my face. I threw up my arm to cover my eyes. I'd been in the dark so long, the light hurt. When I lowered my arm, I screamed, thinking the sluggers had jettisoned me into space. I stood surrounded by stars. I dropped to my knees, comforted by the solidity of the floor, even though I couldn't see it, expecting at any moment to be sucked into the gelid void, frozen and dead. It took a moment for my brain to process that I wasn't floating in space. I perceived no walls, no ceiling, no floor, yet that I was alive proved that some kind of barriers protected me. The slugger who'd led me into the darkness was gone, as was the hallway from which I'd come. It shouldn't have been possible. I was surrounded by heaven. The sun, the moon, the earth, and all those living stars. They weren't static like in pictures taken from impossibly far away. They breathed. They glowed. They were future and past, possibility and memory. They were beautiful.
I never knew there were so many, I whispered.
We are merely pieces of a grander design, even more insignificant than I imagined. When the earth ceases to be, all those stars will shine on. Our deaths will mean nothing to them.
I feel so small. No one replied. I wondered as I watched the stars, really seeing them for the first time, whether they could see me too.
Time travel. It begins 1,000 years from now. Dr. Jao Hattori discovers time travel. A new and exciting industry emerges from the breakthrough. Those willing to pay the exorbitant fees are shifted backward in time to view history firsthand. Time tourists can finally discover the truth about who shot JFK. They can watch the first majestic performance of Hamlet. They can dine with Cleopatra or Queen Elizabeth I or Amelia Earhart the evening before her ill-fated flight. Future humans infest history like cockroaches. The problems begin when the North American Alliance's Prime Minister sends soldiers to the year 2213 to prevent the Texas uprising that turned much of what was once known as the United States into an atomic wasteland. The plan succeeds, which is the problem. History becomes fluid. Factions with varying agendas fight to rewrite the events of the past to their advantage. The government that controls the past controls the future. The Guild Imuab, an anti-time travel organization, forms in response to the deconstruction of the past. Citizens applaud its goals while condemning its methods. Its members destroy art and literature, kill famous figures throughout history, demanding time travel cease or they will dismantle the whole of time. They sow chaos to bring attention to the plundering of humanity's history. World leaders declare war on the Guild Imuab, vowing never to bow to the will of terrorists. Emmanuel Roth arrives in Geneva on 29 January 2016 to destroy the Large Hadron Collider, the site of the groundbreaking discovery of gravitons, without which time travel would be impossible. Emmanuel knows that scientific progress cannot be stopped and that someone else will eventually discover gravitons, but he admires the symbolism of the act. At 10:19 UTC, Emmanuel detonates a fission bomb, atomizing the Large Hadron Collider, CERN, and most of Switzerland. Emmanuel is unaware that the Large Hadron Collider is active. An infinitesimal fraction of a second prior to the bomb's detonation, two particles collide with such fierce velocity that they form a microsingularity, a black hole too small to see with the naked eye. It would have lacked the energy to sustain itself under normal conditions. However, the fission bomb provides it with all the energy it requires to grow and become self-sustaining. As the Earth's core is devoured by the black hole, the resulting radiation vaporizes the outer layers of the planet and expels them, and all life, into space. The future destroys the past, destroys the future. 3 November, 2015. Mom let me stay home from school on Monday, but refused to allow me to skip Tuesday. She believed that the sooner I returned to my normal routine, the sooner I, and everyone else, would forget about the incident. That's what we're calling it. It's certainly better than referring to it as the everyone saw Henry Denton's blurry balls in that one picture escapade. Anyway, it's impossible to forget about something that haunts me every time I close my eyes. I have to shower with the curtain drawn back and the door locked, and forget about sleep. Dawn and I have become fast friends, and I don't expect that will change any time soon. Tuesday morning I was sitting at the kitchen table nursing my second cup of coffee, and wondering if I knew anyone I could score something stronger off of, when Charlie strolled in wearing a dress shirt and tie. He grabbed a Mountain Dew from the fridge and chugged it. "Come on," he said, hardly looking at me. "I'll take you to school on my way to work." I was the only person in the kitchen, so Charlie had to have been speaking to me, but he'd never offered me a ride to school before. "You don't even have a car." "Hurry up, Henry, I don't want to be late." Charlie grabbed my backpack and headed out the front door, leaving me to toss my dishes in the sink and follow. Charlie's Jeep was running when I got outside. The engine rumbled and coughed and smelled like burning oil, but it actually worked. I swung into the passenger seat. "Holy shit, dude, you fixed it."
"It was nothing," Charlie said, but the giant smile plastered on his face said otherwise.
It was the first time I remembered seeing my brother proud of anything other than a particularly putrid fart. The guy beside me, I didn't know him. The aliens must have replaced him with a robot. Charlie stalled the Wrangler when he put it in reverse and swore like it was his primary language. I figured I still might have to walk, but he threw it into neutral, got it started again, and we took off. I hadn't expected the Jeep to make it out of the driveway under its own power. Charlie had taken something that was broken and made it whole again. "What's up with the fancy tie?" I asked. Charlie hadn't even worn a tie to Jesse's funeral, but today he was decked out in a dress shirt, gray pants, and a black and silver plaid tie. He tugged at the neck. "Zoe's dad gave me a job."
"Doing what?"
"Computer stuff." Charlie shrugged like it was nothing. "Fixing laptops and helping stupid people figure out their email." As a kid, Charlie had disassembled everything he could get his hands on. CD players, watches, our clothes dryer. But he'd never shown much interest in putting them back together. Somewhere along the way he changed, and I missed it.
"What about college?"
Charlie sighed. "I've got responsibilities, Henry. Anyway, I'm not cut out for more school."
"Is this what you want?"
"I love Zoe. We'll figure out the rest as we go." We hadn't spoken much since he pissed on my homework, but my attack and humiliation at the hands of Marcus made my fight with Charlie seem petty and unimportant. Brothers fight, and then they move on.
"What do you even know about babies? You can barely look after yourself."
Charlie punched me in the arm, but Nana could have hit me harder.
"Look who's talking, space boy."
"You're a dick." The brakes squealed and the body shuddered when Charlie stopped at a red light.
"Listen, you can't let people intimidate you, bro."
"I wasn't intimidated, Charlie. I was attacked." I could still feel the tape around my wrists, see the smooth patches where it had torn the hair from my arms, and my groin ached when I took a deep breath. Every movement was a reminder that I was a joke, every pain a reminder that I was better off not pressing the button. Charlie gripped the cracked leather steering wheel so hard his knuckles turned white.
"Guys like that, they're pussies."
"Thanks for the brilliant insight.
I'm serious."
The light turned green. Charlie gunned it, trying to shift quickly through the gears, but it stuck in third, and the transmission chewed metal like it was grinding bones.
"If I'm going to beat someone up, they'll see me coming. Only cowards attack a kid in the showers."
I knew, in his own way, my brother was trying to make me feel better. But Charlie doesn't know the meaning of subtle. He probably can't spell it, either. I looked out the window to discourage him from talking. It didn't work.
"You need to cut it out with the alien crap,"
Charlie nodded to himself. He was conveniently forgetting the fact that he was the big mouth who told the whole school about the alien crap in the first place.
"You make yourself a target."
"So you're saying I asked for it? That I got what I deserved?" Charlie backhanded my shoulder.
"Jesus, Henry, you know what I mean."
"You're not a father yet, so stop trying to act like one." Charlie was quiet until we pulled up to the front of CHS. He stopped me when I tried to hop out of the Jeep.
"If you want people to treat you normal, you have to act normal."
A few of the other students being dropped off cast stealthy glances in my direction. Spaceboy was back for their amusement. "I never asked to be treated normal, Charlie. I just want to be left alone." Someone left an alien mask on my chair in Ms. Ferraci's class that I discovered when I slipped in right before the final bell. I wasn't kidding about what I said to Charlie. I really did want to be left alone. I made certain I was the first person out of class and the last person in. I froze when I saw the mask. I recognized it immediately, and the memories of the attack rushed at me in a torrent I couldn't stop. I felt the paint oozing down my skin, felt them kick me in the balls, but I refused to let them see me upset. I made my bones steel and my skin chainmail. I was diamond on the outside, and I would not break. Inside, though, I was already broken.
"What's the matter, space boy?"
came the hideous whisper. I didn't look at them. I just stood by my desk, willing the mask to disappear.
"Henry, is there a problem?"
Ms. Ferraci's voice sounded scratchy and distant, like a faded recording.
"Henry?"
I yelped when she touched my shoulder. She saw the mask and reached past me to grab it.
"Who put this here?"
The rest of the class stared at me, at their desks, and no one spoke up. The attention made everything worse. I should have brushed the stupid alien mask to the floor, But I hadn't, and now Ms. Ferraci was going to wave that thing in the air until someone copped to leaving it on my desk.
"Tell me immediately, or I will simply fail you all for the semester."
Ms. Ferraci was trembling. I should have been flattered that she cared, but I hated the feeling of every student in the classroom looking at me, despising me. I doubted she'd actually flunk everyone, but there was a chance, and they would blame me.
"Adrian did it."
Audrey Dorn spoke loudly and clearly. She turned to look Adrian in the eyes.
"I saw him put it on Henry's desk."
"Bitch," snarled Adrian, but Ms. Ferraci rounded on him.
"Get your bag and report to Principal DeShield's office at once."
She towered over Adrian as he gathered his belongings, glaring at me and Audrey and Ms. Ferraci.
"I need a pass,"
Adrian said in a voice resembling a growl.
Ms. Ferraci shoved the alien mask at him. "Here's your pass."
Adrian elbowed me on his way out, likely already plotting his revenge. Even though he had gotten into trouble, and Audrey had handed Ferraci his head on a platter, I was the one people would talk about, the one they'd laugh at between classes. My skin began to itch like I'd been sunburned and blistered, and my stomach filled with bile. Ignoring Ms. Ferraci's concerned shouts, I fled the classroom for the restroom. I clamped my hand over my mouth to keep from puking until I reached the toilet. It wasn't food that made me sick. It was knowing that I was Space Boy, that I would always be Space Boy, that poison infected every cell, and I vomited so hard that I felt my muscles tear from my ribs. It wasn't enough.
"Henry?"
I recognized Marcus's voice and threw my shoulder against the stall door. My nostrils burned with snot and bile, and I wiped my mouth with the back of my hand.
"I told Ferraci I forgot my book in my locker, but I wanted to make sure you're all right."
"Get the fuck out!"
I was shaking, scared of what he might do. "I know it was you!" Marcus's shadow floated back and forth across the tile floor, but he didn't try to open the stall.
"It was only a joke."
I wasn't sure whether Marcus was talking about the mask on the chair or the incident. Not that it mattered.
"That wasn't a joke, Marcus. It was felony assault. What's next? Acid in my face? I hear hot tar and feathers is a real crowd pleaser."
I was trembling so badly, the door rattled, but my rage was the only thing keeping the terror at bay. I imagined Marcus standing in front of the sinks, trying to figure out the right thing to say to make me see he wasn't to blame. Telling himself he was a good guy and it was my fault if I couldn't take a joke. I wished it were Audrey on the other side of that door. I wished I'd forgiven her and that we were friends again, because without Jesse, I was alone. I got my phone out of my pocket and began typing a text to send her, begging her to rescue me from Marcus, but I deleted it and put my phone away.
"For what it's worth, I'm sorry,"
Marcus said after a few moments of silence. I'd begun to think he'd left.
"Are you going to tell anyone?"
"Don't worry, Marcus. I'll keep your secrets. All of them. I don't want people to find out about what we did any more than you do." Diego found me during lunch, sitting on a bench beside the library. The weather was too warm to eat outside, but I couldn't endure the cafeteria with all those people looking at and talking about me. I didn't have an appetite anyway.
"I texted you a couple of times."
There was coldness in his voice, a distant calm. I was sure he knew about the attack, had probably seen the pictures, but he was being maddeningly blasé.
"More like 30.
I was worried.
I wasn't in the mood to talk. Diego nodded and sat beside me. He was wearing flip-flops that exposed his flat feet and hairy toes.
"Who attacked you, Henry?"
"I already went through this with the cops."
"I'm not the cops."
"Just drop it, all right?"
"I've told you about my sister, right?"
Diego didn't wait for me to answer.
"Viv was wild when we were growing up. She's got her shit together now, but when we were kids, I didn't think she'd make it out of high school without a felony record."
He coughed and cleared his throat.
"She was great, though. When I was 7, I think we had this storm come through that knocked out the power for hours. Our parents had gone into town, and I was so scared. Viv found a bottle of champagne in the back of the fridge and made us champagne ice cream. We played penny poker until our parents got home. My pop whipped us both pretty good, but it was worth it. Another time, when I was 9, Viv was climbing this huge cottonwood in our backyard, Dad had told her a million times not to, but that was probably exactly why she did it. She slipped and fell, smacked her face on a branch coming down, came screaming to me all bloody and purple. Thing was, she wasn't worried about her nose being broken. She was scared of being grounded for climbing that stupid tree. Mom lost it when I took Viv inside. I told her I was playing ninja and had tackled Viv and accidentally broken her nose. When my pop got home that night, he beat me so hard he ruptured my spleen. Diego chuckled like a ruptured spleen was hilarious. I looked for self-pity in Diego's eyes, tried to figure out why he'd told me. "Did your dad really do that?" Diego lifted his t-shirt. A faded scar ran down his stomach to his navel, marring the smooth, tan skin. Another scar, jagged and more fresh, cut across his left side above his hip. He dropped his shirt back down before I could examine it further. "I'm sorry that happened to you, but what's your point?" Diego clenched his fists, took deep, even breaths. He said, "I protect the people I care about, Henry." "It doesn't matter who attacked me. It matters to me." For a moment, I considered telling him it was Marcus and probably Adrian and Jay who'd attacked me. Maybe he would have turned them in. Maybe he would have beaten them bloody. All I know is that he wouldn't have done nothing, which is why I didn't tell him. "The sluggers..."
"Who?"
"The aliens," I said. "I call them that because they look like slugs. Well, they told me the world is going to end soon."
"How soon?"
"January 29th. Diego arched his eyebrow.
"That's pretty specific."
"It's the end of life on Earth. Specificity matters."
"Did the, sluggers tell you how?"
I shook my head. "But they told me I could prevent it. All I have to do is press a red button on their ship."
"Strange. And sort of anticlimactic."
"I thought so, too. Most people would have written me off as a delusional lunatic, but Diego treated me like he believed what I was saying, or at least believed that I believed it."
"So, at Marcus's party, when you asked me about saving the world, you weren't speaking hypothetically?"
"Not so much."
"Did you press it?"
"Not yet." Admitting that to Diego, telling him about the button and the end of the world, made the burden slightly more manageable. It was still my decision. No one could make it for me, but I didn't have to carry the weight of it alone.
"It'd be easier not to," Diego said, "wouldn't it?"
"Yes," I whispered.
"Because you missed Jesse."
The muscle along Diego's jaw pulsed, and it was a while before he spoke again.
"You've already made up your mind, haven't you? That's why you won't tell anyone who attacked you. The world's gonna end, why rock the boat, right?"
"No. I don't know." I'd admitted more to Diego than I'd meant to. "Do you want me to press it?"
"I think I want you to want to press it."
"Oh." It wasn't the answer I'd hoped for. I didn't want to be responsible for the fate of humankind. I could barely be responsible for myself. We sat in silence, each roaming our own thoughts, until the bell rang and the walkways flooded with chatty students on their way to classes. The one good thing to come from being attacked was that Principal DeShields transferred me from gym to study hall. Diego escorted me to my new class without asking, and I didn't tell him how grateful I was. Before I went inside, Diego tugged my sleeve and said, "So I know it's still a couple of weeks away, but my sister's having a Thanksgiving barbecue. It's absolutely going to be lame, but it'd be cool if you dropped by." The suddenness of Diego's invitation confounded my ability to speak. After what I'd told him, I was sure he'd want to distance himself from me. "We usually do family dinner."
"I figured, but you could come before. Or after."
"Why me?" Diego cocked his head, looked at me with his green-brown eyes before he said,
"Because I can be myself around you, even if I don't know who I am yet."
"Oh."
Diego broke into a welcome grin. "Anyway, you gotta try Viv's potato salad before we all die."
"It's that good?"
"No," he said. "It's terrible. But you can't believe how bad it is until you taste it."
I laughed in spite of myself. "I'll think about it."
"Good enough for me."
4 November, 2015. I leapt out of bed at 5:16 a.m., awakened by Chopin's Sonata No. 2. I knew what time it was because I stubbed my toe on my desk, knocking over my alarm clock, which fell onto the cord of my lamp and dragged it to the floor, breaking the bulb into 100 invisible pieces that I was sure I would step on later. By the time I steadied myself and made certain my toe wasn't broken, I had so much adrenaline pumping through my veins that it was like I'd snorted a cup of coffee grounds. Bleary-eyed and ready for war, I stumbled into the living room, but I wasn't the first to arrive. Nana sat at the piano, which she hadn't played since her memory began to fade. Her bony back straight, her fingers swept the keys delicately, then hard, alternately caressing and torturing music from them. Mom stood behind her, arms rigid at her sides. I was about to ask what the hell was going on, but Mom held her finger to her lips before I could interrupt. A moment later, Charlie and Zoe joined us. The little parasite bulged in Zoe's belly, and she rested her hands on it. Mom didn't need to tell them to remain quiet. As my anger faded, Nana's song consumed me. I'd grown up listening to Nana play the piano. She had even tried to teach me when I was little, but gave up because I had clumsy fingers. And I'd heard stories of the concerts she'd played in her youth, before she married and had my mother. This was different. These notes were raw. They rose and fell, soared as the chords were layered atop one another. They ached and bled, and we bled with them. This was every fear and horror her mind could conjure. The music showed us what she couldn't say, all her emptiness and despair, the hollowness of her mind without her memories, the way she saw the world as a cold, dead place. She had tried to tell me, to tell us all, but I hadn't really heard her until that moment. Abruptly, Nana stopped, her fingers paralyzed, arched over the keys. She tried to continue, searching desperately for the right chords, but the notes were discordant. She banged the piano, her frustration mounting. "I can't remember how it goes!" Mom rested her hand on Nana's shoulder. "Mother, it's the middle of the night. What are you doing in my house? Get out of my house!" Nana didn't see us. She saw people, but not us. She fixated on the song, her arthritic fingers hunting recklessly for the next note. "Nana," I tried, but she screamed, "Leave me the hell alone, all of you!" and slammed the keys. Mom's shoulders shook. I stood helplessly, unsure what to do. I was worried Nana was going to hurt herself. Charlie brushed past me and sat on the bench beside Nana. Without speaking, he began to play. Haltingly at first, but as his confidence grew, each note flowed from the one that preceded it. Charlie's song, though different from Nana's, stoked her memory, and she began again. He played a joyful counterpoint to her plaintive dirge, his notes light and hopeful to drive back the desolation of the future. "I've never heard anything like it, and doubt I ever will again." Nana sighed as the song ended, the final note lingering in our ears, stood and shuffled back to her room. I'm not sure whether we were more stunned by Nana's behavior or Charlie's. Zoe kissed his cheek as he wrapped his arm around her shoulders. "We're going back to bed. I have to work early." I can't help thinking that if we live long enough, we'll all eventually forget the lives we've lived, the faces of people closest to us, the memories we swore we'd hold on to for the rest of our lives. First kisses and last kisses and all the passion between the years. We have to watch Nana's life slipping away from her like a forgotten word. I thought I understood what's happening to her, but this isn't like being robbed a penny at a time. Memories aren't currency to spend, they're us. Age isn't stealing from my grandmother, it's slowly unwinding her. "I can't do this anymore," Mom said. I held her hand. "You won't have to."
10 November, 2015. Mathematics rules the universe. The Earth orbits the Sun, traveling at an average speed of 107,200 kilometers per hour. The actual speed can be determined at any point in the Earth's orbit by using the distance to the Sun and the specific orbital energy. The Earth also completes one full rotation every 23 hours, 56 minutes, and 4.09 seconds, and has an axial tilt of 23.4 degrees. Because of the constancy of the math that governs these events, I can tell you with absolute certainty that on May 1st, 2091, the Sun will rise over Calypso at exactly 6:45 a.m. and will set at 7:57 p.m. Scientists even theorize that if you could take the position, speed, trajectory, and mass of every object in the universe and feed it into a supercomputer, you could predict the future of everything. Predicting my routine over the days after the attack was far easier. I lost myself in the minutiae of life. Charlie drove me to school each morning, and I watched him grow more comfortable in his shirt and tie, and more confident in his role as a father-to-be, though he still found time to torture me. His new favorite game was to stick his finger in my mouth every time I yawned. Diego and I continued to eat lunch together. Sometimes we skipped the cafeteria, but most days we found the quiet end of a table and pretended the other seats were empty. I still haven't figured out why he's wasting his time on me, when he could easily fit in with any clique he wanted. He's a chameleon that way. He seems to change personalities the way he changes styles, and that makes it difficult to figure out who he is. The only time I catch a glimpse of the real Diego Vega are when he's talking about books or art. Sometimes I think about pushing him to talk about his family, about why he moved to Calypso from Colorado. But my goal is to simply survive until the world's end, and that does not include antagonizing Diego. Nana officially resigned from lunchmaking duty, and on Tuesday, Mom packed leftover fried chicken, which I shared with Diego. I offered him the thigh and kept the leg for myself. He peeled off the skin and ate it first, savoring each bite. This is killer. My mom uses ground unicorn horn and the blood of virgins for the coating. In truth, I don't know what's in her chicken, but I love it. Laughter drew my attention away from Diego, toward the lunch line where Audrey Dorn stood with her arms extended like she was frozen mid-pirouette. I didn't understand what was happening at first, because her scoop-necked shirt was brown, and I couldn't see the spilled soda until the rivulets reached her white pants. All the kids at the nearby tables were cracking up, but Adrian Morse was doubled over. I hoped he pissed himself. "Don't you know that girl?" Diego asked. "Audrey?" "Looks like she's having a rough day." Audrey shook the soda from her hands, not caring who she flung the drops on, and stormed out of the cafeteria, leaving her lunch tray on the floor. Adrian stood up and did a fairly accurate impression of her stance and walk. Possession of the mask hadn't been sufficient proof for Principal DeShields to link Adrian to my attack, but harassing me with it had earned him a 3-day suspension. He'd returned more vicious than before. "I don't want to sit through study hall," I said, trying to change the subject. "It's better than P.E. "True, but Mr. Weiss spends the entire period posting on brony forums." "That should surprise me, but doesn't." "And Chloe Speedman smacks her lips when she chews gum, which she does constantly. If I have to spend another hour there, I might consider self-immolation as a form of protest." Diego leaned over his tray, his arms resting on either side, and poked around his lunch for any crumbs he might have missed. He was the only person I knew who ate faster than Charlie, but there was nothing left. "Let's ditch."
"And do what?"
"Whatever."
"I hear whatever's fun this time of year."
Diego rolled his eyes.
"Come on, man, don't you want to get out of here?"
"Yeah, but..."
"How can you make an informed decision about whether to save the world if you never leave your tiny part of it?"
The bell rang, but we didn't move. Diego was staring at me so hard, it was like he was trying to force his thoughts into my brain. I know it was only my imagination, but I felt like I could hear a chorus of Diego's encouraging me to say no to class and yes to anarchy. Diego was one variable no equation could predict. Being in survival mode for the next 75 days didn't have to mean I couldn't have fun.
"Fine, but we're not going to the beach."
Diego and I loitered on the side of the math building while we waited for the final bell to ring. Vice Principal Martin patrols the parking lot between classes, making sure only students with passes escape. He locks the gate the rest of the time, but it's hardly a deterrent, since all you have to do is hop the curb and drive around it. VP Martin cruised the lot for a couple of minutes after the last bell before heading back toward the administration building. Diego grabbed my arm and motioned for me to follow.
"Who gives their kid an $80,000 car?" Diego asked.
He was eyeing Marcus's Tesla, though he could have been talking about any of the cars. The parking lot was full of Lexuses, BMWs, and Mercedes.
"The McCoys."
Diego raised an eyebrow and glanced again at Marcus's sleek ride. Even though I hated him, I couldn't deny it was a beautiful machine. We reached Diego's car and he breathed a sigh. He stuck the key in the ignition and turned. Nothing happened. Not even the car's characteristic wheeze that I'd come to know well.
"Come on, please start, please start, please start."
Diego cranked the ignition again, but "please start" refused to.
"Maybe the battery's dead."
While Diego tinkered under the hood, doubt gnawed at my resolve. Mr. Weiss wouldn't care if I snuck into study hall a few minutes late. I could have lied and told him the cafeteria burritos gave me stomach cramps, even though I'm smart enough never to eat those cheesy laxative bombs. This was a stupid idea. Skipping classes wasn't going to change my mind about pressing the button. It wasn't going to bring back Jesse or make Marcus and Adrian disappear. Even if we found something to do, my shitty life would still be waiting for me when the fun ended. I was about to say so when Diego slammed the hood and said,
"She's toast."
"I guess we should go to class." I tried to sound crestfallen as I grabbed my bag and got out of the car. That's when I saw Audrey speedwalking toward us. It was really more of a trot.
"Problems?" she asked.
"We were planning to ditch," I said. Audrey glanced nervously over her shoulder.
"Were?"
"Car trouble," I said.
"I hate to break it to you, but Martin's headed this way."
Diego sighed.
"We're not going anywhere in this thing."
I swore I could hear the predatory whir of Martin's golf cart approaching. Audrey fidgeted with her keys. She kept looking behind her, her eyes wide and dodgy.
"Listen, I'll give you a ride off campus if you want, but we should hurry."
"It might be safer to go back to class." I'd agreed to skip school with Diego. Catching a ride with Audrey hadn't been part of the plan.
Diego snorted. "No way. Marks will give me detention. I don't do detention."
"Now or never."
Audrey took a couple of steps toward her car and disarmed the alarm. I wasn't paranoid. I could definitely hear the golf cart's motor. I'd earned some sympathy because of the attack, but I doubt I'd be able to weasel out of a detention if Martin caught me trying to skip.
"Fine. Let's go."
Nobody said much as we left campus. Vice Principal Martin chased us out of the parking lot, but he couldn't catch Audrey's V8. I wasn't sure what Diego and I were going to do without a car after Audrey dropped us off. Ratting out Adrian for the mask didn't make us even. She pulled into a CVS and parked. Diego hopped out and stretched his legs.
"Thanks for the save."
"Yeah,"
I mumbled. Audrey looked at me in the rearview mirror.
"I never pegged you for a skipper."
"You're one to talk."
I noticed she'd changed out of her soda-stained clothes and into jeans and a tank top.
I needed to get out of there."
"I know the feeling."
Diego wandered to her side and offered his hand through the open window.
"I'm Diego Vega, by the way."
"Audrey Dorn."
"Henry's told me nothing about you."
Audrey flashed him a wry smile.
"I bet."
"Seriously," Diego said. "All I know is that you used to be friends."
"It's whatever," I said. We'd managed to escape school, but we didn't have a car, and I didn't want to spend the rest of the day in a drugstore parking lot.
"Where are you headed?" "Home, probably," Audrey said. "Me and Leah and a couple of other girls had plans to go to the fair tonight, but they've been avoiding me lately."
Diego perked up.
"Fair?"
"It comes around every year," I said.
"Is it far? I haven't been to a real fair ever."
"I don't know. Maybe we could go this weekend." "What else are you going to do today?" Audrey asked. "It's not like you've got a car."
Diego was so excited he was practically bouncing up and down, and I didn't want to disappoint him. Hanging out at the fair with Audrey wasn't how I'd planned to spend my afternoon, but she had a point.
"Come on, Henry," Diego said. "It'll be fun, I promise."
"Do you think you can stand hanging out with me for a few hours?"
Audrey's lips hinted at a smirk I knew well. I sighed dramatically.
"You did sort of save my ass." twice, so I suppose I can make an exception.
Audrey shrugged.
Then I guess we're going to the fair.
The last time I attended the fair, Audrey and I were still friends, and Jesse was alive. I thought Jesse was happy, though in retrospect, the signs were there that he was going to fall apart. It wasn't any one big thing. It was the way all the little things added up and compounded. He didn't kill himself because of a single overwhelming problem. He died from 1,000 tiny wounds. Audrey walked ahead of me and Diego, moving with the line, which was longer than we'd anticipated. Clearly, we weren't the only ones skipping the last two classes of the day, but it still wasn't as busy as it would have been on a Friday night or a Saturday afternoon.
"There's no way you survive living in a house without internet."
Audrey's head was cocked to the side, and she jutted out her hip.
"Please tell me you're joking."
Diego shoved his hands into his pockets and shrugged.
"Wish I could."
Diego had been telling us about life in Colorado to kill time while we waited to buy the bracelets that would let us on every ride at the fair. He'd casually mentioned having to go to the library to check Snowflake, which led to the conversation we were having.
"Next you're going to tell us you didn't have cable, either," I said.
"No TV at all," Diego said, a shy smile on his face that made me wonder if he was messing with us.
Audrey inched forward with the line.
"Were your parents Amish?"
"Nope, just poor."
He said it with a simplicity that expressed no regret and asked for no pity. It was just a statement of fact. Audrey began to stammer.
I didn't mean...
Diego patted her arm.
"Don't worry about it."
"Seriously, I...
"Her family wasn't always rich," I said. "Her mom invented this recyclable paper coffee cup that holds in heat but keeps the outside from burning your hand."
"Seriously?"
Audrey blushed and glanced at the trampled grass under her feet, like she was considering digging a deep hole and crawling into it.
My mom's a genius."
"My mom knits sweaters for cats."
Diego's deadpan delivery was so good that I didn't know whether he was telling the truth, and I busted up laughing at the image of grumpy cats and ugly sweaters. Audrey relaxed. I was in awe of Diego's ability to always know the right thing to say. At the front of the line, Audrey and I got into a fight when she tried to pay for all of our tickets. Diego stealthily paid the admission while we were arguing, causing me and Audrey to join together in righteous indignation. But all was forgotten and forgiven by the end of our first ride on the pirate ship. We stared at our twisted reflections in the mirror maze. 8 powder-sugar-dusted elephant ears, banged out our aggression on the bumper cars, and got sticky fingers from cotton candy. I was sweat-soaked and flushed, and I couldn't remember the last time I had laughed so loudly or smiled so often without having to fake it. Diego grabbed my and Audrey's hands and pulled us toward the flying saucer with the garish blinking lights.
"Whatever that is, I want to ride it."
His curiosity was insatiable, his joy infectious. He approached everything he did like it was both the first and last time he was ever going to get to do it. Audrey glanced at me knowingly, and not because of the obvious UFO reference. The last time I'd ridden the Gravitron was with Jesse. He killed himself 68 days later. I said, "I'm okay," and we crowded onto the ride, shoving past some preppy parents who dragged their whining, disinterested brats alongside them. The dark, muggy interior was a 90s fossil. A dream frozen in amber. The ride whirled around and tilted up and down, but it never moved forward. We shuffled to our narrow slats along the wall and leaned against the cracked and taped vinyl panels. I tried not to think about the parade of filthy people who had previously stood in my place, sweat matting their hair, soaking into the headrest.
"All right, partners,"
shouted the lanky-haired metal band reject at the center of the Gravitron.
"Let's get this thing a-movin' and a-shakin'. Yee-haw!"
I bet he drinks heavily to smother the shame of what his life has become, and dies of liver failure by 43, I said. Diego laughed, and I wanted to preserve the sound in a jar for the days when laughter was scarce.
"Yeah, right," Audrey shot back. "Two funnel cakes says that's you in 10 years.
"In 10 years we'll all be gone."
Audrey gave me a perplexed look. But Diego shouted,
"Fuck that, I'm gonna live forever,"
as the ride fired up and the room lurched into motion. Diego howled, earning us glares from the preppy parents who probably presumed we were drunk, and the wave of bad music continued to assault our ears as
Creed blurred into Nickelback. The trucker hat-wearing scarecrow at the controls continued yee-hawing like anyone cared. We were swept up in the spin, and in the smell of metal, and vomit, and bleach. I was swept up in Diego Vega, in the way he sounded like he honestly believed he'd never die, despite my telling him the whole world was on borrowed time. In the way he looked at me like I was someone other than Spaceboy, a way that was impossible and endless. Diego looked at me and saw me. No one had seen me since Jesse. The ride spun faster, so fast that gravity squatted on my chest and pushed the air from my lungs, and then faster still. Jesse fought the centrifugal force and flipped onto my panel, straddling me, his curly blonde hair hanging in my face, his body pressed against mine. Audrey glared at us, disgusted, and the conductor yelled for Jesse to return to his slab. Jesse ignored him. Rules didn't apply to Jesse Franklin, and I loved him for it. We were whirling around so fast that Jesse couldn't hold his head up any longer and buried his face in my neck, his chapped lips grazing my skin. He was insane, and I told him so as I wrapped my arms around him so tightly that nothing would ever tear us apart. I nipped at Jesse's ear and ran my hands up the back of his shirt. His skin was sticky with sweat. He smelled like the ocean. "Never stop," whispered Jesse. "I don't plan to," I promised, and meant it. The ride slowed, and our bodies began to separate, but that only made me hold Jesse closer. He kissed me so hard that I cut my lips on his teeth. Jesse and I disappeared into a world where we two alone existed. "Honestly," said Audrey as the ride slowed to a stop, "can you stop dry-humping my best friend?" But we pretended we didn't hear her, and I wrapped my arms around Jesse's neck, and he kissed me like the world had fallen out from under our feet. We were two bodies floating in space, brighter than stars.
When the ride ended, Diego left me and Audrey hanging out by the tilt-a-whirl while we hunted for a toilet. I didn't say much, and neither did Audrey. I was pretty sure we were both thinking about Jesse. Audrey picked at the peeling paint on the side of the ride and kept repeating that she was having so much fun. After the 100th time, I craned my neck to look for Diego.
"How long have you guys been together?" Audrey asked.
I was standing on my tiptoes, looking over the crowd, and her question didn't register right away, so I said, "Yeah, sure."
"Then what?"
Audrey had this way of making you feel like the dumbest person in the room. She didn't do it on purpose, but when she looked at you, you knew her brain worked on a level many times greater than yours.
"I'm glad you're not with Marcus anymore.
If he doesn't roofie someone before graduation, I'll be shocked."
"Diego and I aren't together. He's straight."
"Really?"
"Yep."
Audrey furrowed her brow like she was staring at a math problem that had been marked wrong when she was certain it was correct. The calculations didn't make sense, and Audrey hated for things to not make sense.
"The way you were looking at him on the Gravitron, I was thinking about Jesse."
"Oh, but you like Diego, right?"
I wanted to tell Audrey how conflicted I felt, how I sometimes thought about Diego while jerking off, how when I tried to recall memories of Jesse, Diego appeared in them instead. Jesse was dead. He'd committed suicide. But I still felt like I was betraying him for liking a guy who wasn't even capable of liking me back. Audrey was maybe the one person who could have understood, and I wanted to tell her, but I didn't.
"Drop it, okay?"
"Fine. What do you want to talk about?"
I spotted Diego walking toward us, but he stopped in front of the bumper cars, and I couldn't see why.
"I don't know, Audrey." "Come on, don't be like that." Everything about her was pleading with me to let it all go. Her eyes and her lips, and the way her shoulders slumped.
"We did fine not talking at all for the last year," I mumbled.
"Maybe you were fine, but I needed you."
Diego had clearly run into someone, but I couldn't see who it was.
"I was here. I'm not the one who left. I just needed that stupid kid with his stupid balloon to get out of the way so I could see who Diego was talking to. I was hurting too, you know."
Standing in the middle of the fair was not where I wanted to have this argument. I didn't want to have it at all, but Audrey was maddeningly persistent. "Yeah, you were hurting so bad you took a 3-month vacation to Switzerland. That must have been horrible for you."
"Henry."
A passing family obscured Diego, so I turned my full attention to Audrey. The festering wound split open anew, spewing a geyser of pus.
"You didn't even say goodbye, Audrey.
I showed up at your house, and your dad told me you'd gone to stay with family in Switzerland. I thought you'd come back after winter break, but you were gone for 3 months. People turned to stare at us, but I couldn't stop draining the abscess. Jesse killed himself, and you were the only person I could talk to about it. I needed you, but you didn't answer my emails, my calls, nothing. My boyfriend, your best friend, committed suicide, and you abandoned me. You both abandoned me. Tears filled Audrey's eyes, and I hated myself for causing them. I hated myself for needing her. I wanted to hate her for leaving, but I didn't, and I hated myself for that, too. You got to see Jesse at his best, but I saw him after he punched a brick wall so hard he broke his fingers, when he cut his thighs with razor blades, when he put out lit cigarettes on his hands and told you he'd burned himself baking brownies. I was the one who cleaned up his blood and made sure he didn't drink himself to death. Me, Henry, not you. I didn't learn about those things until after the funeral. I spent weeks scouring old texts and pictures, looking for the clues I'd missed, thinking about the times I suspected something was wrong but didn't push Jesse to talk about it keeps me awake most nights. I failed Jesse. We all failed him. Why'd you leave, Audrey? I needed space to breathe. So you went skiing? Audrey was shaking. I looked for Diego. He was still by the bumper cars. She clenched her fist so tightly, I thought she was going to punch me. I wasn't in Switzerland, Henry. What? I don't have family in Switzerland. Audrey bit her bottom lip and said, My parents checked me into a psychiatric hospital. I spent 8 weeks there, and then another month with my grandparents in Jersey. I was tempted to believe she was lying to gain my sympathy, but going on an extended vacation after the death of her best friend had never seemed like an Audrey thing to do. I'd accepted it as the truth, because she'd given me no reason to think she was lying. But this, that she'd been in a hospital, made sense. Why didn't you tell me? Jesse and I had a pact. He swore he'd call me if he were thinking about hurting himself. He called me that night, but I didn't answer. He was upset all the time, and I needed a night off. She paused. I thought it was my fault he'd killed himself, and I didn't tell you because I couldn't bear for you to blame me too. Instead, you ran away, and I blamed myself. The crowd blocking my view finally moved. Diego was talking to a short girl, perky with pink glasses and a blue stripe in her blonde hair. I think she attended our school, but I didn't know her name. She covered her mouth with her hand when she laughed and kept touching Diego's arm. Diego hugged the girl and pointed toward me and Audrey. He probably wished he'd come with her and was likely plotting some way to ditch us. I needed to leave, Audrey said. I was hurting so bad that I wanted to die too. It took me a long time to realize Jesse's suicide wasn't my fault. Don't you know how sorry I am? I don't know what else you want me to do. Diego walked toward us. The crowds parted for him. He waved. I returned it robotically. I wish I'd killed myself instead of him. I kicked at the ground, blinking to keep from crying. I wish no one had died, Audrey said. I wish Jesse were here, singing and telling bad jokes and going on and on about some stupid book he read. But he's not, I said, and it's our fault. Yours, mine, it's everyone's fault. Or no one's. Fuck, I don't know. When Diego reached us, he stopped a foot away and said, What's going on? Audrey wiped her eyes. Sometimes I hate him, Henry. Mostly I miss him. Yeah. And I miss you. I didn't know what to say. Audrey had been Jesse's friend first, but I missed her too. My feelings for her were buried under scar tissue built up over 103 lonely nights spent wondering what I'd done to drive away everyone I cared about. My father, Jesse, Audrey, they'd all abandoned me. Audrey had her reasons, and I could see that, but it didn't erase the pain. Not entirely. I stood there, my arms hanging limply at my sides, unsure what to do next. Audrey glanced at her phone. Maybe we should call it a day. Diego furrowed his brow.
Well, we haven't even gone on the Ferris wheel yet.
His voice was filled with a child's enthusiasm, a desire for life that Jesse's suicide had stolen from me and Audrey both. The suggestion of a smile played on Audrey's lips. What do you think, Space Boy? Don't call me Space Boy. Diego threw his arm around my shoulders and Audrey's too, drawing us to him. His skin was warm and sweaty,
but I didn't pull away.
No deal. You're our space boy, space boy.
The way Audrey looked at me, as if we could somehow fill the canyon that had grown between us with laughter and meet again in the middle, made me